already acclaimed in boardrooms the world over, How the Deal Was Done brings together the most interesting and candid dealmakers in investment history. And now, How the Deal Was Done, with your host, Laura Queen, founder and CEO of 29 Bison.
Welcome to How the Deal Was Done. I'm excited to join Andrew Sherman for today's conversation. He's an attorney, professor at Georgetown University, and an expert in mergers and acquisitions. Andrew, thank you for joining us. Would you give us a few moments of introduction?
Sure. I thought you told me I had about 20 minutes to talk about myself, and that would be the bulk of it. No, I'm just joking. I've been in the M&A legal field for about 40 years now. I've written 26 books on various M&A topics, but also on general business growth. Been teaching at Georgetown at the law school for 12 years, been teaching at the Smith School at University of Maryland for nearly 35 years. So I teach in both MBA and then MBA style to the law students to make sure that they understand the business and strategic aspects of the transactions that they'll be working on for the rest of their lives. I'm very convinced that most of our nation's law schools are not teaching enough raw MBA style business skills to give, you know, lawyers the business vernacular that they need to interact, you know, with professionals like you.
We have an interesting commonality in that I believe strongly HR professionals also need to understand the linguistics of business. So.
Yeah. Last time I checked, communication was a two-way street. So you're 100% right.
Got it. Andrew, tell me, we'll talk about this in greater detail in a moment, but I'm really interested in understanding your perspectives and what got you interested in the value of intangibles and how that connects to M&A from your perspective.
Yeah, that is a fantastic question. As a kid, I always had, you know, the fruit stands and lemonade stands and lawn mowing businesses. I've been interested in business. My parents told me I used to carry around when I was just 2 years old, this big champagne bottle and have people fill it with coins when they came over. I mean, it's the capital markets, the dynamics of business growth, which of course include both organic and inorganic growth, which includes M&A, how companies grow, why they grow, what the impediments to growth are. I'm indifferent whether I'm on the buy side or sell side of the transaction. Sometimes I'm even on the financier side of the transaction, which is kind of the third leg of the triangle there. But when I'm representing sellers, I love knowing that the next couple of generations or their lives are going to be affected by the work I do. I know it sounds hokey, but it's true. I mean, I've been through billions and billions of dollars on the sell side and seen a lot of very comfortable people who, you know, now have access to resources they never dreamed of as a result of something I contributed to. On the buy side, it's very gratifying to see companies go through their buy versus build analysis, land on the buy side of buy versus build analysis, and then you're helping them implement a strategy. So, you know, I don't want to sound like Larry the Cable Guy, but I love to get her done and, you know, move on to the next transaction and hope that, you know, that track record can continue until I'm ready to hang up the running shoes.
Love it. When you're advising clients, either buy or sell, as it relates to intangible assets, how do you help them understand what lives in those buckets and how they can create or what they've done has diminished value?
Another tremendous question. So they're very different answers depending on which side of the transaction you're on. If you're on the sell side, the biggest risk to America's entrepreneurs and middle market companies is leaving chips on the table. You know, imagine, Laura, that you were selling your home in Pennsylvania, and unbeknownst to you, in the attic was a series of gold bars. And you don't know because you've never been up there and the attic's kind of musty, and you sold your house without knowing that those gold bars were up there. And I buy your house and all of its contents. Guess what? You know, I own the gold bars now. And it's analogous to that in the M&A process. Many sellers, I'd even say 80% of the sellers, leave too much value on the table by not articulating to the buyers what their various intangible assets are, which we'll get to in a minute, I think, with one of your questions. On the buy side, it's the complete opposite experience. On the buy side, you are trying to find homes that have 18-karat gold bars in the attic, and the seller's not aware. And the better you can be at strategic due diligence, at finding pockets of value, embedded assets, other things that will enhance, you know, just valuing companies off a multiple of EBITDA feels very 1980s to me. You know, I think what you have to look at as a buyer now is what is the totality of the assets, both tangible and intangible, and can you structure a deal that allows you to maximize and monetize those assets after closing?
Andrew, something that is near and dear to our hearts in the world of 29 Bison is the people aspect of deal making. So that includes the employee experience and the things that the employee contributes to in terms of value creation for organizations. I'd love your view about where people sit in the accounting for value in an organization.
Well, I can only give you my view.
Sure.
And in my view, people sit at the, as my grandson would say in New York, at the tippy, tippy, tippy top, Pops. They sit at the tippy, tippy, tippy top. There is nothing to the company without people. Now, one day with AI and robotics, that may change. But for the moment, I think people still rule. You know, an old friend of mine told me one day, he said, numbers follow, they don't lead. Numbers follow, they don't lead. People's behaviors, their teamwork, their collaboration, their innovation, their creativity, that's what drives financial performance. When Microsoft bought LinkedIn for $25 billion, everybody was like, you're crazy. The company's bleeding value. You know, it hasn't made money yet. How could it be worth, you know, 25 billion times zero is still zero, you know, if it were a multiple of EBITDA. Well, companies, you know, obviously LinkedIn had commercial value. They had leadership. They had technology. They had customer following. They had a whole series of intangibles. And, you know, don't worry about Microsoft. They didn't overpay. They're carrying the asset on the books at 150 billion or more now. So they got the last laugh. But, you know, if we looked at an enterprise like LinkedIn when it was bought by Microsoft, solely on the basis of numbers and not people and culture and innovation, the company would be worth nothing.
So important. It's so, that's so critical. So I'd but love to go ahead.
I apologize. There is one more issue that we should talk about on this particular point. And that is when COVID hit and everybody decided to work at home in their gym shorts. And now everybody's decided they like working at home in their gym shorts, and they may or may not want to return to work. It has gotten harder, not impossible, but harder to assess the people issues relative to culture and engagement and collaboration, because now you can't come into the headquarters of the company and see hundreds of people buzzing around and playing ping pong with each other and, you know, presumably enjoying the workplace, when so many companies have gone virtual. And so it's up to the sellers now to say, hey, we have a great culture at this company, even though we're virtual. We have a great levels of collaboration, even though we're virtual. And we're seeing that to be a bit of a challenge in certain industry verticals where companies are more attuned, you know, to the Jamie Dimon quote from last week about you better come to work or you're not going to be a JP Morgan anymore. And it is a little more challenging to assess from a totality evaluation perspective these people issues when the people themselves get together in person once a year or once a quarter. And I'm sure you guys see that.
It's an interesting point, and we talk about it quite a bit as it relates to culture and its the measurable or immeasurable or qualitative versus quantitative components of culture. And one of the things we talk about quite a bit is how culture can be seen in various artifacts, right? Understanding what the artifacts of culture look and feel like. And some of those are accessible through employee engagement scores, et cetera. But one of the things that always comes back to mind for me is if you are in a customer-facing role, whether it's internally customer-facing or externally customer-facing, your interactions with other people are very much influenced by the culture of the organization and how you feel about that culture, how excited, how enlivened, how engaged you are in the work that you're doing and the people that you are doing that work with, virtually or otherwise. And that can be captured in things like internal NPS scores or external NPS scores. You know, how do other people feel about engaging with me in the right action or activity of my job? What do you think?
I think I've definitely seen more mention of the NPS scores as an element of evaluation. There are other tests, as you know, that also try and test engagement. And one of our middle market clients just had a full-blown Gallup study done on this. And I mean, you know, there's still a little healthy skepticism around, are people telling the leaders of the company what they want to hear, or are they being honest and or are they, you know, highly disengaged and they're saying bad things just because they don't like their Christmas bonus. But you can see it at some point. If your culture and leadership and collaboration is dysfunctional, it will start having an impact on the numbers. And then that affects the M&A and the value proposition from the seller to the buyer. We had a situation with a woman the other day who runs a pretty successful company, but there's pressure on all of her competitors, including herself, to move away from human capital towards an AI model. And she said, I'm torn because I feel like if I go to a full AI model, then what am I even selling to a buyer? And if I don't go to an AI model and keep it old school, will I be penalized for not adopting enough AI? And it seems like the capital markets are struggling with that same issue. One day, if I announce $50 billion in capital spending on AI, my stock goes up 30 points. And the very next day, I announce $50 billion on spending on AI, and my stock goes down 30 points. Wall Street can't figure out yet, because we're at this inflection point of whether this is a positive or a negative. So it doesn't have to be just AI. It could be any form of technology that enhances value of the business without an overdependence on technology that might, you know, get over your skis a bit and end up being a value diluter instead of a value enhancer.
Really good point. So I'll use that as a jumping off point to the next question. I'd love for you to share your views and perhaps even your experiences in working with organizations where they may have over time undervalued intangible assets. What is your counsel to them? How do you ask them to rethink, and what exactly is it that you're suggesting they rethink as they're looking at the value of their business?
So let's look first at the macro and then the micro, if that's okay.
Sure.
The macro, there's a group called Ocean Tomo. They do a study. There's this beautiful chart they have that I've used in a couple hundred speeches, and you may have too. It does get used a lot. It shows the S&P 500 ratio of tangible to intangible value. And back in the 70s and 80s, that ran about 88 to 12. So the typical company had 88% tangible assets, inventory, real estate, equipment, and 12%, you know, goodwill, right? In the 40 years that has then passed, the ratios have flip-flopped even in the S&P 500. So you take a company like Apple and you say, okay, Apple's got a market cap, even with the flopping around the last few weeks, of about $3 trillion. So I ask you, Laura, of the $3 trillion, what ratio do you think is in servers and desks and chairs and laptops? I mean, 10%, right? I mean, 10% is still only 300 billion, right? Or so, I mean, let's make it 20% just for discussion purposes. I don't think they have $600 billion in tangible assets. But that still leaves, oh, $2.4 trillion in market cap on the table. But where is that market cap being captured? You can't just round it. It's not, you know, goodwill is not a rounding error anymore. You can't say, oh, well, it's goodwill. You're going to have to eventually get more specific. Well, what types of goodwill? Is it people-oriented? Is it human capital? Is it intellectual capital? Is it the patents that they have? Is it the ecosystem that they've built? And none of those are captured on their balance sheet, by the way. Our accounting system for these assets is about 50 years old. And it's still living in the 1980s version of the Ocean Tomo pillar. And that's big companies. That's Apple. You can imagine the ripple down to smaller and middle market companies where the ratio of intangibles to tangible in terms of assets could be 90-10, 95-5. I've got one company, they're easily worth a few million dollars right now. It's 99-1. They own nothing that would show up on a traditional balance sheet. So that's the macro. The micro is, if you're thinking about selling your business and you're watching this podcast, please, I'll get down on one knee if I have to. Please, please, please do a pre-sale strategic IP audit and involve some non-traditional people. Involve different people in your company, different sets of outside advisors, people that are trained in the extraction of embedded intangibles. And, you know, I think you would be a key member of that team in the right strategic exercise because you'll be focused on the people side and the human capital side. And everything flows from that, in my opinion. So the best thing to do is don't go to market. You know, if you've got an investment bank that's just telling you about EBITDA this and EBITDA that and hasn't punched out, you know, your strategic intangible assets and presented them with value to the buyer, then you're no better than the person that was too lazy to go up into their attic and see that they had a big box of 18 karat gold bars. And how sad would that be? You know, we're trying to create GDP and tax base and wealth in this country. And my fear is too many of these gold bars are just sitting collecting dust. And that scares me and it should scare all sellers, every single seller. And don't tell me, oh, we're not a tech business. We're a restaurant chain. Restaurant chains filled with intangible assets, from recipes to brands to customer loyalty to databases to all kinds of things that they just don't identify it or categorize it as an intangible asset. But I can assure you this, it's of great interest to the buyer, and most buyers love it when they're sitting on their hands and won't go up into the attic.
Right. Right. Yeah, as you're sharing both of these examples and metaphors, I'm thinking even in any business where you have customer facing interaction, like the restaurant industry, safety is one of those things, right? We think, you know, we think about particularly in the world of, you know, post-COVID, et cetera, you're thinking about PPE and, you know, some of those kinds of things that we didn't pay a whole lot of attention to previously. And, you know, it's just,
I'll give you another one that's very relevant. Supply chain. I mean, if you have a supply chain that is not going to be subject to tariffs and you can remove the tariff risk in the eyes of the buyer, your company probably just went up 20 to 30% in valuation. If you've got a supply chain that's very dependent on the tariff seeking countries, you may have just lost 20, 30% value and you didn't do anything wrong. It's right. Situation, it's macro, you know, geopolitics and macro market conditions. We don't think about companies that way. You know, I was on the phone just before this podcast with a client in Ohio that's going to be selling their business. And I said to him, and this wasn't me trying to be political at all. I just said, what's your Trump risk? And he said, what do you mean? I said, what elements of value are influenced either by taxes, immigration, tariffs? He said, I can't think of any aspect of our business. I said, great. You have a very low Trump risk score. I said, some of our other clients, particularly in and around the Beltway, are not so lucky. I mean, government contractors are getting hammered on their valuations. We have a client in DC who has 6 of his 8 major contracts were just frozen. put on hold. Guess what? His plans to sell the business are going to have to be put on hold. Right. How can you make that case to a buyer? So intangible assets are both within the four walls of the company, but also outside those four walls. What's happening in the world relative to risk of enterprise value, and how do you drive that? Like on your side, you have businesses that have very high turnover rates, and you have some companies with very low turnover rates. Which would you want to buy? I want to buy a company with very low turnover rates. I want to understand what they did to facilitate loyalty and trust and continuity and succession. And to me, those are assets much more valuable than how many old, you know, machines I have that are fully depreciated in my warehouse, or even inventory, which actually too much inventory today can be a bigger risk than it is an asset.
Right. Yeah. And it raises, to my mind, certain circumstances we've had with employers in, or acquirers in this case, interested in investing in organizations that are largely reliant on immigrant labor, for example. In what happens when you have individuals that are here on temporary visas waiting for, you know, approval, immigration approval, and that doesn't happen. And these are low wage earners. Where do they go to replenish a depleted workforce? It's very difficult.
Our younger generation has no interest in those jobs.
Right. Right.
And I'm not getting political. It's no. Just there is a good 10-20%. I mean, of, you know, from cleaning up your dog's poop in your backyard to stacking shelves and inventory. And I mean, and those aren't jobs that are going to be too easily replaced by a robot. I mean, right. Maybe one day in our lifetime, but not
today.
Someone has to do those jobs. And the business models of these companies are dependent on someone doing those jobs. So yes, let's not go down that rabbit hole far, but it's for your listeners, it's another example of an intangible asset that they may not realize they have.
Right.
And they don't bring it out in their presentations and their killer decks and PowerPoints. The buyer's not going to do it for them. I mean, let me just take my example one more time with the house and the gold bars. What's the likelihood, Laura, do you think that if I were buying your house and I discovered the gold bars and you didn't know they were there, that I'm going to call you and go, you know, Laura, we were up in the attic poking around because we were thinking of converting it to a kid's bedroom. We found a big box of gold bars. You know, I just want to make sure that you're fairly paid for those gold bars since those would be included in the house. What do you think? 1% chance of happening? 2% chance of happening? 0% chance of happening? In corporate M&A, if I'm doing due diligence on a company and I see elements of intangible strategic value, I'm not going to offer it up to the seller. I'm going to hope we close as quickly as possible so I can start monetizing and getting revenue and profit opportunities from those assets.
That's exactly right. Great jumping off point to talk about how did you get into M&A, into the world of transactions, and what is it that inspires you about it?
Well, one of the stories that I won't bore your listeners with had to do with being a young associate, and the night before a small asset purchase deal closing, I realized that the math didn't add up, that the purchase price was $500,000 and the list of assets only added up to $490,000. I checked my math about 20 times to make sure I was not off. I sweated all night. I couldn't sleep. I come in the next morning and my boss said, oh, don't worry about that last 10,000. We'll just call it goodwill. I thought, goodwill? Like Goodwill Industries? Like, what are you talking about? I was unfamiliar with the term. And so ever since that day, which was maybe 3 months into my practice 38 years ago, I've been interested in goodwill. What does goodwill really mean? How does it get interpreted? How do companies with negative earnings get bought for $26 billion? How does that happen? And I've been fascinated with that since. It led to the book, Harvesting Intangible Assets, that I wrote in the TED Talk that I think you've seen. But what is happening in the world of M&A right now is more and more transactions are being driven by these intangible assets, and that's not going to change. You know, I don't see it going back to industrial smokestacks of the 1950s anytime soon. So lawyers who want to practice in this area, if you don't know the basics of intellectual property law and intangible assets, I mean, it's borderline malpractice. I mean, I'm not trying to be dramatic, but it's borderline malpractice to not know what these assets are, how they fit into the business. And it's not just borderline malpractice on the seller side, leaving money on the table. It's borderline malpractice on the buyer side in not identifying these assets as elements of value. If I'm on the phone with a buyer and we're trying to make a difficult decision about a particular concession and there's no intangible assets, that's going to be a different conversation than if we've identified three really cool intangible assets that the seller really has not leveraged or utilized in any way. Might be more likely to make headway on that concession so we can take control of the asset. So it really influences every aspect of the transaction, from the reps and warranties to the holdback to availability of insurance. I mean, it's becoming a critical component of enterprise value.
That's a really important point. We've seen the world shift. You know, when we started doing this work, we saw quite a bit more activity inspired by or motivated by the risks, compliance risks, and other risks in these deals from a diligence standpoint. And you know, a number of years ago, we saw all of this change around the idea of value creation. You know, it wasn't just about understanding where there were compliance risks and really opportunities. I mean, we deal mostly in the middle market and, you know, real opportunities to professionalize or to create more mature, sophisticated HR practices. But it became more than that. You know, how do we put succession planning in place? How do we develop really capable individuals inside the work environment for retention purposes and for organic growth aside, the inorganic growth? You know, how is it that we create a more satisfying employment experience because we think as good corporate citizens, we should be doing that? And Gallup polls and others have told us that these things are really important. So I think, you know, a nod to those organizations out there that I believe are doing really good work with the right intentions around taking care of people. And we're seeing more and more of that in our experience, which is stellar.
100%. I can't tell you conversations I've had recently with sellers who say, but what about my people? What can we do to make sure they have good jobs after closing? What can we do in terms of retention bonusing and incentivizing them to get across the finish line? I 100% agree. You know, what great buyers do, and this is probably the most important point I'll make in the entire podcast, although hopefully there have been more than one. What great buyers do is they see things that the sellers can't see for themselves. You know, you mentioned you had some background in the life sciences industry. There's a particular drug. We won't talk about it because it's somewhat politically incorrect, but where the side effect of the drug is what created the thing that now, let's just say, many men buy the drug for. Okay.
Right.
You know, if this podcast was rated PG or R or whatever. But let's just keep it.
Yes.
So what
the unintended consequences.
Yes. But what if all you could see from that compound was the intended consequence and not the side effect or the unintended consequence? If I were buying that compound knowing that the side effect was where the real market lied, mm-hmm. and the seller can't see that for themselves, and they're just selling a compound that was really not a great success until we realized the market was in the side effect, you know, I'm going to be paying a lot less for that company, particularly if it's a numerical driven transaction. And I just bought something whose post-closing market value is 10 times, 20 times, 30 times more valuable than what the seller thought it was. And I'm not trying to, you know, snooker sellers. I mean, I said earlier in the podcast that it drives me crazy to see sellers leaving money on the table. But if they're not going to make the effort, they're not going to bring in the right advisors, then shame on them, you know, because there's always a smarter buyer out there that's going to see the embedded value and see the ways to monetize the embedded value after closing.
So one of the things we pride ourselves with in this podcast is telling fun stories. I'd love for you, Andrew, to share a story, a deal-making story from your career, something that stands out to you. How has it impacted how you view the world of deal-making, and what advice would you give to people?
You know, I've worked on hundreds of deals, maybe thousands, and it's hard to pick just one. I think the one that was the most interesting, and it did involve some intangible value argumentation. I led the Walmart transaction into India with Bharti. I had to go to Delhi 14 times over 12 months. I thought my frequent flyer accounts at that time were my bank accounts. And I was, oh, yeah, I've got $1 million in United Bank. Oh, that's points. Oh, well. And what I saw there was not just all the classic logistical and cross-cultural issues, but a negotiation between two companies that each thought they were pretty darn valuable when it came to intangible assets. I mean, Walmart brought to the table the systems that drive, back then, $600 billion in global revenues. But the Indian joint venture partner and master franchise partner brought knowledge of the local market and a brand reputation in that market. And we had hours and hours and hours of discussions around how to balance those competing intangible assets in structuring the transaction. And a few times, let's say my Philly roots came out and I was not controlling my language, and I was literally pulled out by one of the Walmart executives who said, "Now, son, we just don't talk to people like that, you know, in Bentonville." I was like, okay, I got it. But that was, it was very interesting also because, you know, I got to know the Walmart culture and some of the leadership, and, you know, they take their, you know, whether you're a fan of Walmart or not, they take their missions and values very seriously. They still conduct themselves as if Sam Walton was in the room at all times, and they stand for one thing and one thing only: to deliver the best price to the end customer. And you gotta, you know, that's a good example where the company's mission and values and culture were one of its greatest intangible assets. You know,
so beautiful.
What's that saying? You can have better, faster, cheaper, pick two, right?
Right, you know, right.
All three. So pick two. And they've definitely focused on cheaper and a pretty good customer experience. I mean, I'm a regular Walmart shopper, and I'm proud of it, but that's just because I enjoy value and I enjoy getting good value. So, but that was probably the most interesting. There were a lot of middle market deals where what was gratifying was helping the seller identify those assets prior to closing and watching the purchase price go up. Probably the most severe was a deal that was being valued at $40 million by an overseas buyer and ended up paying $300 million by actually a buyer in your backyard, whose name I can't say, but they're headquartered not too far from Bluebell. So that was an interesting transaction because I could look at my client eye to eye and say, yes, I incrementally added $240 million to your purchase price. And, you know, people get pretty excited about that.
Mm-hmm. Sure, absolutely. That's amazing.
I mean, $40 million after taxes is a nice amount of money, but it's not like, oh my God, buy a yacht kind of money. $300 million, whole different echelon of purchase price.
Absolutely. That's beautiful. What a great story. So, Andrew, as we think about wrapping up, your advice, if you were giving advice, let's start with sellers and then give some advice to them and then share from a buyer's standpoint, what advice would you give to each of these constituencies in the world of deal making?
On the seller side, know your business inside out and go to untypical businesses. You know, there's a great story, I think it involved Dairy Queen in Japan, where Dairy Queen was losing customers And they didn't, you know, they brought in all the fancy consultants and all this stuff. And they ended up solving the problem through a janitor in one of the stores in Tokyo who kept taking out of the trash can all these half-eaten ice cream cones. And the janitor said, you know, in America, you may eat ice cream cones that are bigger like this, but in Japan, our tradition for dessert is a couple of little bites. You should be serving cones that are smaller. And so it didn't take McKinsey or Bain to figure it out. It took the guy cleaning the trash. And you'd be surprised if you take the time to do one of these strategic IP audits and you have all the right people in the room from different parts of the organization, be surprised how many processes, systems, channels, relationships, you know, culture, you know, engagement, assets that you may not even realize you have. And even in a smaller company where you think you know everything about your company, you may not. So that's the sell side. The buy side, just please do not engage in M&A. I don't care if you're a private equity buyer, a strategic buyer, a hybrid. You know, private equity tends to look at deals through a horse-blinded mathematical valuation construct, and either fits their construct or it doesn't. But if you do that as a private equity fund, you're leaving the intangibles on the table. Your team needs to look at these companies more holistically. I think you'll end up being more profitable, and you will have identified the assets that you need to put in place and monetize when you go to flip the company. Because many of these private equity firms, it's buy it, build it, flip it.
Beautiful. And we completely agree with you. Every time we have the opportunity to spend time in some level of intimate conversation with folks inside the business, regardless of the level, the amount of just watershed information you get about creating value or improving processes or creating more effective and productive work environments is monumental. And it's, you know, we're a third party and we're an objective observer asking questions that for the most part aren't influenced by being a part of the organization.
And by the way, the converse is also true. If I'm the manager of a private equity fund and I'm about to overpay for a company and you get in there, 29 Bison, and say, this is one of the most dysfunctional cultures we've ever seen. Please do not overpay for this company. I would suggest a purchase price adjustment of X, Y, or Z. This company hasn't innovated since 1968. Something is terribly wrong here. So either walk away or pay a lot less or change the terms. You're adding just as much value for identifying the problems as you are for identifying the opportunities.
Absolutely true. It's happened many times.
I'm sure. That would be when I get my own podcast, I interview you and you can tell.
Lots of stories to tell.
Yeah, I think we need a part two of this.
The reverse interview. Andrew, this was amazing. If our guests and our audience are interested in contacting you, how should they do that?
No, I'm not interested in hearing from anybody. I've got enough friends. I'm just kidding. All of my book information is on the Amazon author website. I've got some great titles out there relating to M&A and due diligence and governance and disengagement. I hope people will check it out. And all of my contact information is, of course, on the Brown Rudnick website. It's brownrudnick.com, and that's got my email address, my phone number. If there's anything that we've talked about that's of interest to you, I'm happy to take a complimentary call and brainstorm it with you. I think this is a great podcast. You know, how the deal got done, we need more content around that, and so I'm happy to come back. I'm happy to reverse interview, and I'm happy to hear from some of your viewers. Anything that we can do to be helpful, we're happy to do it.
Fantastic, Andrew. Thank you so much. What a wonderful conversation. I wish you all the best. And for all of our listeners, thank you very much for tuning in to How the Deal Was Done.